listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
My name is Janan Raouf, and I will be hosting today's episode of Muslimish Freethinkers. We are a podcast affiliated to an organization called Muslimish, and tonight our subject is going to be prayer. We will have three very interesting guests, Wissam Sharafuddin, who's from Detroit, Nora Imbebi, who's currently in India, and Zarar Shahzad, who is in New York. We're going to be talking about prayer because prayer plays a really important role in the lives of Muslims. It is the second most important pillar of Islam. And so we are going to discuss what prayer meant in people's lives before they started to have doubts about Islam and how they're relating to prayer now that they are Muslimish. So that's going to be our subject for tonight. If you are interested in our podcast, we'd really like you to support us by subscribing to patreon.com/Muslimish. You can also visit our website, Muslimish.org, if you want to learn more about the group and more about the podcasts that we are going to be producing on a regular basis. So let me start with my guests. Nora?
Hello. Hi, Janan. I'm really excited to be here today.
I'm really happy to have you. Zarar?
Hey, Janan. Also excited.
And Wissam? Wissam?
Hi, everyone.
Good.
Not as excited as everyone else, but no? Actually, I'm very excited actually about this.
I'd like to start by asking Nora what it was like when she was a practicing Muslim and how prayer played out in her life as a believer, and particularly in her family life.
Wow. Okay. So I think I'll start with what prayer meant to us as a family, because I was the youngest of three siblings. And growing up, it was our father mainly who taught us about prayer. And being the youngest, you always see your elder siblings going through learning something first, and you sort of observe it before you partake in it. So my father started off by teaching us like Surah Al-Fatiha, and he would kind of like show us the motions. It was considered a very, very serious responsibility. Once we reached a certain age, that it just stopped becoming optional. And we had to...
At which age? Nora, at which age does it start to become obligatory for a believing Muslim to start praying?
I can't remember exactly when my father started to make it obligatory for us. But I want to say it was even before, like much before we hit puberty. So I think it was maybe around the age of 10 or so, 9 or 10 maybe, where it started to be taken seriously. And I was also attending, Janan, you know this, but I was also attending Islamic school at the same time. So prayer was actually part of our school schedule. So it just became a fact of the day.
So can you explain to us how many times a day a Muslim is required to pray?
It's five times a day are the mandatory prayers. And there's one called Fajr, which is at dawn or before dawn. You're supposed to start praying. And then before the sun rises. And correct me if I'm wrong, anyone. And then there's Dhuhr prayer, which is in the early afternoon or morning time. And then there's Asr, which is in the afternoon. And then there's Maghrib, which is at sunset. And then there's Aisha, which is at night. after the sun has already set. So those are the five prayers, and they're considered obligatory. And so we did, as a child, I did all five, but my father was really lenient about Fajr because it required us to wake up at dawn, and we would not, he would not make us wake up. So he would allow us to pray Fajr when we just woke up in the morning time, before Dhuhr.
Wissam, was that your experience too?
My experience is a little bit.
Of course, I mean, all the Muslims experience the same prayers. This is one of the things that is common among all Muslims is the five daily prayers, although there is little differences in the way they're performed or in the, you know, the combination of the timings, the intervals of the prayer timings, etc. But in general, all Muslims, they have that in common, which is the five daily prayers. And they are one of the most important pillars of Islam.
And can you explain to us why? Can you explain to us why it is so important? Why is the prayer so important?
Because it is said to be important. It is emphasized in the Holy Quran. It is emphasized in the traditions of the Prophet. That, you know, it is one of the arkan al-Islam, the pillars of Islam. If it's accepted, everything is accepted after it. And if it's rejected, everything is rejected after it. It is one of the defining characters of Muslims. There is numerous traditions about prayer. And the Quran also, there are numerous verses about prayer.
So it's very central to the practice of it, because my sense is that when you say Allahu Akbar, that God is greater, that you're supposed to leave whatever it is that you're doing, and that it's a kind of daily affirmation of the fact that God is the most important thing, and that there's nothing more important at that point to be doing than praying.
Yes, before I get into the subject of prayer, Jinan, there is a distinction, because when we talk about prayer in English, the word prayer, it splits mm-hmm. to two meanings in Arabic. One is prayer as supplication, like dua,
right.
And one as prayer, like the form of worship. So, and these two things are two kind of different topics in Islamic practice.
Today we're talking about the ritualized prayer, the salat, which is the prayer that is performed five times a day, which is kind of a ritualized prayer. Okay, it's not great. When you're...
Yeah, right? So I wanted to make this clear to our audience that we're talking about the ritualized prayer, which is the salat. So... So I grew up in United Arab Emirates, and I started prayer very early on. I mean, I've seen my parents, my grandparents pray in front of me, and it's kind of, it becomes a form of a game, right? Like toddlers, they copy their
parents,
and it's a very cute thing that they, you know, copy them in the prayer form. And you grow up and you go to school and you learn prayer and you start praying. I think from grade one is when we started actually praying even in jama'ah, like in collective prayer.
So you didn't feel it was enforced, because Nora was talking about it being enforced by her father a little bit. And Zarar, I want you to jump in as well. Was your experience of when you first started learning prayer, was it something that you had a lot of freedom, or is it... Was there a form of discipline that your parents would remind you, that you have to pray?
I think maybe my experience was a little different than Wissam and Nora's. My family is a more liberal upbringing. But so I did learn prayer from my dad, who was more practicing. And we prayed, but it wasn't – I felt guilty when I wouldn't pray, but he wouldn't really force us to pray. My dad always thought that we should do whatever we wanted to do. But I did, like Nora was saying, at a very young age, I learned how to pray. I learned, you know, the different prayers. The one thing I wanted to just add, I guess, that we're talking about the importance of prayer in Islam. The one other thing about prayer is that it's often done in groups, right? That was one thing that to me was different about the way the Muslim way was done, is that the Salat, often you're encouraged to go to the mosque, you're encouraged to do it with other people. And that sort of communal aspect was also something to me that was interesting about the way Islam did it.
Was that your experience too, Sam? Because you said you grew up in the United Arab Emirates, so you would have been around people and you would have had very easy access to mosques. Was that your feeling too?
Wassam is praying right now, I think. That's why.
Sorry. No, I had just a little trouble with the mic. Yes, definitely. So prayer is part of the culture that I grew up in. Let's say we're playing soccer, we will meet each other after Asr in the mosque. We are getting together at night. Okay, let's meet at this specific mosque at Maghrib. Everyone prayed. Actually, my parents, they were more liberal, so they really didn't enforce prayer or expect me to pray, and they prayed occasionally. I didn't see them really pray regularly. But the environment in the school and my friends, it just was something that is very common and expected and a very happy event. And it was very, very normal and part of the daily practice that you don't feel you're doing something different. You know, in a country like United Arab Emirates, everything stops at prayer time, and there are places to pray everywhere in the country, in every company, in every mall, in every corner. There's barely any distance between one mosque and the other. The way I grew up, it was the dominating indication of time. So usually between Maghrib and Isha, for example, there's a short period of time. So, you know, you don't do major activities between these two times, because it's a very short time. Usually do them after Isha, you know. And there was no recollection of me having it enforced whatsoever. The first time prayer was enforced on me is when I transferred into the Islamic Institute. In the Islamic Institute, it was obligatory for everyone to pray Dhuhr in a collective way in the school. And, you know, like teachers would go around and catch students who are missing it, and they would get a punishment, and they, you know, they would bring them to the prayer room to pray. It wasn't an option. Everyone had to pray.
And that was the first time in your life that it was actually enforced, you're telling me.
And I was praying voluntarily anyway. And it was, you know, I mean, it's a break from studying, and the mosque is very well air conditioned. So it was a relief from the, you know, classrooms, which were not very well air conditioned. So, I mean, in that circumstances, I had no problem. But I saw it enforced. I saw students getting punished for not praying. And that's the first time I see it enforced.
Nora, I'm interested because you had talked a little bit about, we know that perhaps your relationship with prayer is going to be a little bit different in terms of time, because there are times of the month when a woman is not supposed to pray if she's menstruating. So if you could tell us a little bit about how that monthly cycle interacted with prayer, for example, because this is a very specific gender perspective on how prayer plays out in a woman's life. If you could talk about that.
I'm so glad you said the M word, Janan. I was actually thinking, as you were speaking, as Wissam was speaking also in Zarar, that I think there are important differences between prayer for men and women, especially when you talked about the communal aspect of it. I didn't really feel that much of a communal aspect as a woman because, well, of course, so the Friday Jummah prayers are not considered were not considered obligatory for me. And the only times that I prayed with a group was in Islamic school. And once in a while, if there was a large gathering at home, you know, my father would lead us, Allah, or another male relative would lead. And then we would kind of just stand behind them and follow. So
it was it more of an activity that you associate with solitude and contemplation and being on your own then?
Yes, I think most times I was in a room by myself. In a quiet place by myself praying. But definitely, just to circle back to the menstruation, I think prayer made it so that menstruation was emphasized and monitored and spoken about. It became like the.
What do you mean monitored? What do you mean monitored?
So I just had I happened to have a father who believed that I should be praying as much as possible. And because of that, he would frequently ask me, you know, his question would always be "Saliti, saliti, saliti," which is like, "Did you pray? Did you pray?" And once in a while, I'd have to say no, and he would say, "Go pray now." And then I would say, "Well, I can't." And it became like the "I can't," which indicated that I was on my period. And then afterwards, he would count the days. So he would say, "Okay, it's been a few days now, saliti." And I would have to explain to him that the duration of menstruation for a woman is 7 days, roughly speaking. I'm sure it's different for different women, like give or take a day or two. And then my father would explain to me that menstruation is only supposed to be for 3 days. And I just didn't know where he got this piece of information from. And I felt like that was very odd because both I had two older sisters and we all menstruated for 7 days. And so it almost started to feel like he felt like we were trying to get out of praying by
saying that you have a, yeah.
Even though we really,
weren't. Maybe we should just explain to the audience that a woman in Islam, if a woman is menstruating, she's absolved of having to pray or fast during Ramadan because she's considered to be in an impure state.
And
I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that this is common across many cultures and other religious faiths, that when a woman is menstruating, I mean, I was told, and I think Wissam, this came up in the first podcast, that it's not that she's considered impure, but I always wondered if that was a piece of like apologism. I don't know, because the word is najis, but are you najis your whole person or is just your blood najis? But in any case, it prevents a woman from praying. I don't know if you want to jump in, Wissam.
Yeah, Wissam might be able to clarify that for us.
I mean, the word najis is not used to describe a woman who is menstruating.
Not even her blood?
So, but it is, no, her blood is najis, but she is not najis.
Okay.
But she is considered in a spiritual state of impurity. So, as Jinan said, she's absolved from praying, from fasting. It's not obligatory on her to fast. In the month of Ramadan, it's actually forbidden for her to fast during her period. And it is actually not allowed for her to, according to most scholars, to enter into a mosque.
Right.
Unless she's passing through it, if the mosque is in the way of wherever, you know, like in the Middle East, sometimes mosque, you have to pass through a mosque to go to your home, because mosques can be really a large area of land. See, a mosque technically is a land that is dedicated for prayer. Not when someone dedicates a land for prayer, not necessarily they build the building over this whole land.
So you can pass So you can pass through it, but you're not supposed to stop.
You can pass through it. So these are the rules, the jurisprudence regarding administration.
So it does also then have a sense in which it organizes your relationship to time in terms of cycles, when you need to pray and when you can't, and when you are, and people are aware of that, and your father was kind of telling you that and trying to make sure that this was not an excuse for you to not pray, to not perform.
Right. And I also feel, maybe this is because I attended Islamic school, but I felt that prayer I use the word emphasize, but the word's not coming to me. It seemed to sensationalize the menstrual period of a woman, because I still remember, you know, there was this back room that women would be, that girl students would be sent to at Islamic school during the prayer times. So they would unfurl this big curtain to separate the boys and the girls for prayer. It's not that boys prayed in front of girls. It was that boys prayed to the left of girls at this Islamic school. And then as soon as the curtain was fully separating both sections, they would send the girls to this back room. It was like the art studio, girls who were menstruating. And then it became a joke that when the curtains would then close, when the prayer was over and they would reopen both sections, you could catch a glimpse of the women or the girls, coming out of the art studio, because you would know that, oh, those are the girls who are menstruating. So I felt like it
was kind of like, sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, it just felt like sensationalizing something or coming of a woman for no real, like, valid reason. It was such a natural part of our biology. It really didn't indicate that we became women, because we were obviously still girls. And it just emphasized something that I felt like just didn't need to be or shouldn't have been as important a subject.
So in other words, it made you very self-conscious of your body. There was a time when you would be excluded, that there was a time and that people would glimpse and they would know certain things about your monthly cycles. It kind of brought the body into the whole process in a way that probably works very differently for a man or a woman.
Right. It wasn't like a matter of fact attention drawn to it. It was just a very, I don't know, like a special kind of period for you.
Going to Zarar, I'd like to ask you, I know that you grew up in the United States, so I was wondering if the experience of prayer had a dimension of solitude and contemplation that would be different, since you would not necessarily have access every prayer of the day to a mosque. Did that color your experience of prayer?
Did what color? What aspect of, I mean, like, being alone?
Yeah, right. Because you grew up in the United States, from what I understand, right? So you, unlike with Sam, probably didn't have immediate and constant access to a mosque. So did prayer then become for you also something that was done more in solitude and being alone? Was it more of a contemplative practice?
I feel like, you know, actually, as I grew up, it wasn't as big of a deal to me as I think for both Wissam and Noura, like, just because I didn't pray as often early on. And so to me, growing up, it really just seemed like this thing that I did for my dad and this thing we did. I went to Sunday school, and so we might do it in Sunday school. And so, yeah, I never really had, at least when I was younger, it wasn't until older that sort of its meaning changed for me. But when I was younger, I feel like it was just something that either other people did because I went to Sunday school, or that I just did because my dad was around. So it was almost like just this ritual that was sort of done and that I just sort of accepted. So I feel like that doesn't necessarily answer your question about the solitude.
How did it start to change for you as you were getting older? How did the experience change for you as you started to mature?
I mean, so then after I left home, like, I just didn't pray. Like, so when I went to college, like, now I didn't have any of these rules. So I just sort of didn't pray in college. And for a bit after that, I didn't pray. And then maybe a few years back, I started sort of meditating. And I also, at the same time, had started, I also didn't have any real, like, Muslim friends. Sounds funny to say, but I didn't have, like, good Muslim friends growing up. And so the other thing I started having was friends who were Muslim and who would go to Jummah, and then they say, oh, do you want to come? And then I would sort of go with them sometimes. And so what ended up happening was, as I tried to meditate, I found, like, just in the evening, I get really tired and it's really hard to meditate. So I don't know why, I started praying just to see if it worked or something. And it sort of surprisingly ended up having, like, sort of this sort of benefit. Like, so... sorry, let me backtrack there. So the reason I was meditating was because it was for a purpose. It was a goal. So it was no longer a ritual. It was like, I wanted to sleep better and I wanted to improve my focus.
Oh, so it was became more of a meditative rather than a ritualistic practice. It wasn't that you were praying in order to connect with the divine, but you kind of wanted to reach a certain state of meditation and focus.
Yeah, and I guess I wanted to sleep better too. And so I found that when I only meditated in the evening, I found it very distant. And then for some weird reason, like when I prayed, it did connect me with growing up and childhood and stuff, and it had this emotional connection. And so that then helped me sort of calm down. And yeah, so in that sense, it was more like what you might use for meditation or relaxation. So it was something I was doing not for like God necessarily, but more for like, it seemed benefiting me personally.
I'd like to ask my other guests about, you know, now that they are no longer praying in terms of, you know, as a form of worship, are there beneficial aspects to prayer that can be extrapolated from Islamic ritual prayer? Is there a sense in which it is meditative, or a sense in which it can really be beneficial in terms of calming the mind, being soothing or giving comfort? I know that there was a Gallup poll that showed a very large percentage of Muslims who were asked said that they found prayer very soothing and very comforting. So I'm wondering, any of you can jump in about your reaction to that.
I agree, Janin. I think there are definitely beneficial aspects of prayer, but I think it depends on each individual and what their personal experience is with prayer. So, for example, I can recall particular moments when prayer felt like beyond religious, for beyond religious reasons, felt soothing or therapeutic. Kind of like you mentioned before, the solitude before, it would allow a moment to interrupt whatever I was doing and take a moment for myself. And sometimes it's nice to have that solitude, but also, what Zarar was talking about, the communal aspect. So whenever there was Eid, or like one of the holidays in Islam, we would all go to a mosque in Manhattan on 96th Street, and we all loved that mosque because it had so whoever led the prayer on Eid always had a very, very beautiful voice when he recited Quran, and it was kind of like a group experience of appreciating the recital. And even though I no longer believe in the content or the message of what the person reciting is saying, it was definitely a nice experience. I don't want to compare it to like going to a concert and listening to a musician, but it had a similar feeling of we're all here appreciating something together, and it's out of our.
So it had an aspect. So it had an aesthetic dimension, is what you're saying.
Yes. And that was not frequent or common. It was on special occasions, and I think that's what made it special to us. But I agree. I think there were moments where prayer felt meditative to me, like when I would do sajda specifically, which is when you prostrate yourself on the ground. I wish Ibrahim was here because he would have a lot to say about that, about like submitting yourself in such a subservient pose. But I'm not really talking about the pose. I'm just talking about the feeling of your head being on the ground and the darkness that would, I don't know if anyone else relates to this, but like the darkness of kind of like you're shutting light away from your eyes and you close your, I closed my eyes when I was in sajda, and I would feel like the ground on my forehead. And part of that feeling, it would just kind of take me away from whatever I was doing or whatever I was thinking. And it felt like I was truly meditating in that moment.
So you're kind of withdrawing from the world, withdrawing into yourself with the prostration.
Right, right.
And also,
Wissam, what are your thoughts? Wissam, what are your thoughts about this?
So, yes, I want to first say a comment before I go into this question about going back to the situation that Nora has described in mosques regarding the isolation of ministrating women. And they do, because mosques have because it's not allowed for menstruating women to enter into a mosque, they usually have a special chamber or one line in the back of the mosque that is not considered part of the mosque technically, that they can sit in. But this whole situation brings a lot of attention to a physical attribute that is very natural, but I feel it's a negative attention, especially that it is associated with impurity. And also in at my, because, okay, there is objective, you know, analysis of this, and then there's subjective. So subjectively, I found it to be very embarrassing to many girls, you know, being identified as, you know, okay, now everyone's praying, so we're 10, 9 of us are going to pray, and there is this one girl that's left behind, and everyone knows why, and, you know, if someone doesn't know why and asks, then it becomes very awkward. And this continuous unintentional shaming that have, you know, become part of the a girl's experience. So I haven't experienced it myself as a male, but I, you know, just I imagine how embarrassing it can be.
Let's ask Nora if she felt that this was a form of body shaming.
I think I agree wholeheartedly with what Wissam is saying. It is considered a shameful attribute, and it is considered extremely awkward when everyone gets up to pray and you're sitting back. Of course, I find it very humorous now because that happens currently, but because I'm an atheist and everyone knows it, so they all get up to pray. And it's almost like a similar kind of shame. Like, we still won't talk about Noura not getting up to pray, even though she does not have her period. But as far as being Muslim, I think it is very, very true that it's almost not even because of an attitude that a woman has. I think it later becomes internalized. Like, girls learn that it's shameful. Of course, it's not originally shameful, but because of the attitude that they're subjected to, which is, and I can only speak for myself, really, but the way that boys would sort of like whisper to themselves, or the way that it was kind of unspoken that this girl is not right, praying, therefore she must be on her period. And I agree with you. Well, it's entirely natural.
Right. And I guess what you're saying, what I'm hearing, is that it's a moment of standing apart from the group, because it sounds like also prayer is an affirmation of membership in a group. Like, Wissam talked about this, you know, their friends get together, people pray together, you do it during the holidays. So it's kind of, you're affirming you're part of the group, but there's always that moment where the woman stands apart.
Right. And I have to say, maybe I differ a little bit from Wissam on this, because I experienced this in America, and I feel like it wasn't helped by an American setting, because still, and maybe we should have a whole episode about menstruation, but still there was the attitude of, we can't talk about periods, those things are disgusting. And so even in an American setting, with modern progressive thinkers or Muslims, that it was still a very taboo topic, and it was still considered like unpleasant and unclean to talk about it.
Right.
Yeah. So this is you know, in a time that we are trying to be inclusive to everyone, even those who have physical disabilities, physical hurdles. We're trying to do whatever we can to have them included in all kind of activities that we perform. Every time I go to a swimming pool and I see this little powered chair that can submerge a handicapped person into the pool to give them the same experience as everyone else. And I see it as a sign of civilization that every single swimming pool in America now has one. I feel like that exclusion from a form of worship it's not fitting the progress of civilization. There's no reason whatsoever for a very natural biological a phenomena to be treated like it's a taboo in such a way. And I'm sure it has its root in history, why this has become a taboo, but I think we should, you know, and I've read an article in Times Magazine that modern, like reformist Muslim women, they're trying to fight back against that ruling and that separation.
Really? Due to Wissam, could you speak a little bit to like that has on like, do you feel that because women are excluded from typical forms of worship because of menstruation, that it affects their level of religiosity in the eyes of other people?
There is a narration that is sometimes it is present in the book Nahj al-Balagha, which is a book that is a collection of the sayings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. And this book has been written by Sharif al-Radi a very long time ago, but it has been republished by Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, the Sheikh of Azhar, which made it more popular in both the Sunni and Shia worlds. The focus of it is the eloquence of the speeches of Ali ibn Abi Talib, who is the cousin of the Prophet and one of the main figures of Islam. One of the sayings in this book, so this book is controversial in terms of the authenticity of the traditions relating to Ali ibn Abi Talib. But one of the traditions, one of the sayings in the book is that women have a lack of faith and a lack, you know, the famous saying, you know, الناس, النساء ناقصات العقول ناقصات الإيمان ناقصات الحظوظ. They have a lack of luck, lack of mind, I guess, and a lack of iman, lack of faith. The lack of faith is because of the lack of prayer during their ministration, and the lack of mind is due to their witness is half of that of a witness of a man. It's counted, you know, you need two women to count for one witness who is a male, and their luck is their inheritance is half of those. So scholars have rejected this saying. Many scholars rejected the saying that it is not authentically related to or narrated, you know, as a saying of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Nevertheless, it indicates, whether we like it or not, it indicates of a rhetoric that considers women as a second level in terms of faith due to all these restrictions. They are restricted to perform the full pillars of faith during these periods of time. Now, of course, the from an Islamic perspective, modern Islamic perspective, I tell you that it's not obligatory on them. There is no so by the way, the Quran and the Hadith did not talk down on menstruating women. It's just a set of rules and restrictions that creates an environment of exclusion, creates an environment of shaming, but not.
But it
done
does
directly.
Result in the popular imagination, I think, with Sam, in associating menstruation with a lesser form of piety, because there are times when you are unable to worship God.
I think so. I mean, they say, but we have a holy woman like Fatima or Maryam, and the Quran has set them as pedestals, you know, on pedestals as some of the greatest examples for humanity, while they at the same time have undergone menstruation and all these physical symptoms. So they, you know, they say, no, we're not trying to shame anyone because we have women who have, we said that they are better worshippers than all of the men in history, you know, except for prophets. So you know, so, but I'm saying whether they say it or not, whether they say it, no, there is no direct shaming, even if we agree that there is no direct shaming, definitely. There is an environment of exclusion and embarrassment and shaming. You know, if any person is going to be excluded due to some physical trait that is natural and periodic, that is going to create some sort of embarrassment, especially at a younger age. And it will have an effect, like you're saying. It will create an unconscious effect of feeling less faithful. It will need more work to regain that confidence and to regain that impression. It does have that effect. Now, we're talking at the best case scenario. Now, you have the worst case scenario where a woman is mistreated during these times.
Can you give us an example?
I mean, that becomes more cultural. But some cultures, they mistreat women during menstruation, where they it really becomes a taboo beyond religion, where they don't touch them, they don't talk to them, they treat them with some sort of disgust.
I don't really think that happens very much in Islamic culture, though. I mean, I think that it's more of a ritualistic thing. I'm not aware that there are instances where they are physically separated from the group, except in prayer and during times of worship.
Yes, I mean, I agree with you that it is not a prominent behavior, for sure. So shall we go back to the subject of Salat? And I know, like Nora said, you know, we need a full episode about, we probably need to change the title of this podcast. It's definitely very interesting. And by the way, also in Judaism, they have a similar interaction with the subject.
No, it's a really big issue. I was just reading an article, and I was actually reading a book, and they were talking about whether women can be judges or not. And there are some conservative Muslims who make the argument that a woman can't be a judge because of menstruation, because there are times when she cannot swear on the Quran, for example, as a witness. Mm-hmm. So it comes up in different, you know, is that it can be a disabling factor, mm-hmm. not just in being able to perform the ritual prayer, but in being able to perform at higher levels. As an imam, for example, leading the prayer, you can't do it if you are menstruating as a judge. And so it really does have a much larger cultural impact than that. But let's get back, like Wissam said, to the subject of Salat and its relationship to solitude and contemplation. Because you had something you wanted to say before we started talking.
Yes. I mean, it came to my memory that when I was, you know, when I used to be present in mosques as a speaker a lot, and sometimes my ex-wife would have to, drop something off to me. And if she was during her period, then she can't, you know, she can't walk into the mosque. She would have to call me to come out and get it from her. And just recalling that, just the fact that you are not allowed in a place due to a very natural phenomena that is nothing wrong with it. And it's like one third of your life you're in that situation. It's just, for me, it is offensive.
Right.
And I'm sure it is more offensive for a female. And I think this, by the way, the subject of menstruation is not mentioned in the Quran except under the subject of divorce and only related to divorce and marriages, so as I recall, so it there is room for, I mean, I invite Muslim reformists to tackle this subject.
I'd like to get back to the subject of Salat, and I'd like to ask Zarar about how the experience of Salat changed for him when his relationship to Islam shifted.
I was just before I started to go back to the, I just wanted to talk about this topic of solitude and your relationship, like with Islam, with prayer. The one thing I was going to mention is that I noticed when talking to people, both as I sort of started praying more, was that people don't really focus on the benefits that much. They end up focusing way too much on like the exact way you should do it. And it often, like when I sort of like the example that Noura was giving with the sajda, for me, that's one thing I also realized, oh, the sajda is actually this nice, peaceful moment. And you also, if as you guys know, you say the same word repeatedly, subhana rabbi al-ala, which is actually much like when I realized that that's a lot like a mantra meditation. So if you're in sajda and you're repeating the same word over and over again, you can sort of use that as one might for a mantra meditation.
Are you thinking about the meaning of the word, or is it just the sound?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the meaning in a mantra, the meaning sort of should matter, but it doesn't need to, right? The point is, it's this mantra that you repeat that helps focus your attention. But I feel like for most people, it's not like that. It's like, I have to do this because someone has told me to do this. It's the same way when we were talking about women. All those things are because there are certain rituals and someone told you to do it, so I'm going to keep doing it. But no one really thinks like, oh, okay, well, what's the goal of this? What's the purpose of this? So yeah, it sort of reminds me like when you're in school, you end up focusing on grades a lot, but you don't focus on learning. And so I feel like most people's, so I feel bad because prayer can be better. Actually, if you end up tailoring it to yourself, it can be something that can be better for you and improved. But for a lot of people,
But it sounds to me, Zarar, like you did find a benefit to it, because you're talking about it as though it were a contemplative practice. You're talking about the repetition of the words as if it were a mantra. So did you find benefit from it before, when you were actually a practicing Muslim, and afterwards? And if you can compare those two states.
Well, I found benefit to it. So I was sort of mentioning I more recently started praying. So one of the things I noticed, well, like many of the rest of us here, I was sort of like, oh, the prayer goes against like my basic things because it's very ritualistic. It's very sort of set in its ways. And so one of the things I started doing was trying to make it more personal and make it more sort of accommodate to my own ways. So like one thing I mentioned is sort of the sajda. So usually when I'm the sajda, I go for much longer for it. And the other things I started doing was like, some of the things I did might've been slightly blasphemous. So like one of the things was I played with the orientation. So normally when you pray, you orient yourself towards Mecca.
Right.
So I played with that a little. So one of the things I did, sorry to get back to your question, you were asking like, did it become more meditative, or was I able to contemplate it more? And I think the answer to that is, yeah, by changing some things around and making it more personal, I felt like I was able to have a more deeper experience from it.
How did you make it more personal? Can you give us an example of how you made the ritual prayer, the Salat, more personal?
So I mentioned the Sajda, which isn't, I guess, that big of a difference. One thing I did was like, I oriented towards the black, like, so I thought, okay, the Mecca, if people know the Kaaba, is all black and there's a rock there that's very holy and it's also black. And so I thought, well, instead of praying towards that, what happens if I pray towards the black hole that's at the center of our galaxy? That too, like, is this very, I mean, in a way it's almost a divine thing. It's this massive object that moves like, you know, millions of stars around. And so one thing I did was I would sort of direct my prayer towards that and sort of imagine the black hole and imagine all the stars, and it became sort of a spiritual type experience.
Oh, so you were adapting the rituals, but you were making it a more personalized form.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's what I do every time. I take the general purpose. So there's a purpose of orienting yourself, and then I like adapt it in a way that's like, more useful to me, or more useful to modern day, maybe.
Thank you very much. And I think that we've had a really interesting conversation and gotten a sense of the different experiences that everybody has. We've kind of looked at what it was like for Nora as a woman. We've looked at Wissam's experience as someone who prays and feels that he is part of a larger community and that it fit into certain cultural patterns. And Zarar's very fascinating take on how he continues to pray, but it makes the ritual more personal, and how it still remains a sort of a meditative, meaningful practice for him. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.